Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
A look at what's happening across Connecticut. Melissa in the Morning's conversation with Governor Ned Lamont. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Governor Lamont, thank you so much for making the change and coming on earlier in the week. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Doing fine. Hope you're good.
I am. Thank you so much. We have a lot of different questions kind of all over the board this morning that I wanted to share with you. First and foremost, we're still looking at wrong-way drivers. I think, unfortunately, we saw another death just this week from a wrong-way driver. And something I even noticed driving on I-95 over the weekend, we actually had a car almost smash right into us. And when the car got so close, we could smell weed from the car. I mean, the marijuana smell was so strong. And interestingly enough, Susan called in over the weekend and said, you know, with more high drivers on the road, with AAA said we are having more people high behind the wheel. Do we have any data in Connecticut linking wrong way drivers to high driving?
Yeah, back up just a little bit. First of all, we have seen a lot more dangerous and erratic driving over the last couple of years. Some of that related to COVID. For a while, you had fewer people on the driving, and those that were driving like a bat out of hell, and you saw accidents up and driving down. I think now you still see some of that residue. Yes, there is some high driving. Remember, it can be ambient, it can be alcohol, it could be marijuana, or probably some mix of these things, especially late at night. Our cops are pulling people over. You can pull over anytime you want, pull them over for erratic driving, stop them and make sure they're not able to keep going if they're at risk.
Do you know, Governor, if we are collecting data, though, since we, I mean, it's very new. Obviously, legalized marijuana is pretty brand new to Connecticut, but do we have either state police or some kind of a committee who's looking at high driving, specifically people who are high behind the wheel, marijuana?
I think they're trying to track this as best they can. But as I said before, most of it is a mix of things. And frankly, I haven't even started selling marijuana yet. So, but you're right. I think there's a lot of erratic, distracted driving. By the way, put your damn phone down as well. So there are a whole variety of reasons that we are watching this. We have more cops on the beat. We're pulling more people over.
I think naturally, Governor, one of the questions from Susan in this was, do you regret legalizing marijuana if we see more high driving going on?
I don't. I mean, look, you're suggesting there's marijuana-related driving going on. We're not even selling it. They can come from Massachusetts. They come from New York. Or even worse, they buy from some dealer on a street corner. You have no idea what that's laced with. So I have no regrets about having a safe, regulated market out there.
And, you know, as we talk about substance abuse, underage drinking parties, let's talk a little bit about that. Following Jimmy McGrath's death, very tragic, from Fairfield Prep, some Fairfield County schools have started sending me letters that they are getting as parents from the school districts, warning them not to allow for underage drinking parties to happen in their homes. My question to you, Governor, and actually this came from Kathy, do we know where kids are even getting the alcohol? And of course, you know, if you ask experts, they're going to say older siblings, they're stealing them from parents' liquor cabinets, they are getting it from college students, you know, whatever. But I think the question that Kathy is asking is, do we do a good enough job cracking down on fake IDs or even checking stores to make sure they know who they're selling to?
I think the stores, from what the Consumer Protection tells me, and we check this all the time, are pretty good about checking ID, doing a better job of spotting fake IDs. You're right, it's often an older brother who's coming in on behalf of his little brother, which is dangerous. And I do have to urge parents, look, other parents are counting on you. If there's a party at your house, you got to make sure, A, no underage drinking, and B, nobody driving home if you sense something amiss.
You know, and Brian and Shelton actually followed up with a very similar question saying, is there anything that we could be doing for taxis and ride shares, Uber or Lyft? Because oftentimes those drivers, they're the ones who are transporting these kids from underage party to underage party. And unfortunately, that sounded like that was the case in this Jimmy McGrath situation. They came from another party about 2 miles away, and they were transported there. They were dropped off there. Is there something more we could be doing for rideshare programs or for taxis, like to let them know, like a denial of letting people come in, like, hey, where are you going? And you see that they're going to another party. Or is that kind of encroaching on what their jobs are?
I can tell you, Melissa, that on party nights, say New Year's Eve or St. Patrick's, we've worked out arrangements with the ride-sharing companies, not to take you from one party to another, but to take you home if you're incapable of driving and if there's any risk at all there. To your bigger point, if you're telling me these guys are aiding and abetting and driving drunk kids from one party to another, you know, I think they should have some accountability there. So let me look into that.
We're chatting this morning with Governor Ned Lamont, taking your questions directly. And again, we have a lot of different questions here. I know we had a question this morning from Susan who wanted to follow up about following the pandemic and the CARES Act, wanting to know what funding is still in place for businesses that were open during the pandemic and are still having structural issues with existing building, structures that they are in. So if they're having issues with I guess, either rent or staying there or even upgrading their facilities. Is there anything that Connecticut is doing to make available to them to keep them afloat?
I had a lot in that question. And hats off to Susan. She's got a lot of good questions.
Yeah, she's got it together.
Look, we put in place our rent relief program. There's still some resources there. We did it differently than other states, I'll be blunt. Other states said, here's some money. Please go pay the landlord. We said, here's some money. Now go work out an arrangement with your landlord so you get back on full payment. I want to make sure the landlord is taken care of and you have a chance to stay in your apartment. We've made a big effort on that. You know, we're announcing, we're providing support for your first down payment to allow more folks to own a home. Sometimes that down payment is tough, especially if you're also sitting around with a lot of college student debt. So there are some resources out there going forward as the market sorts out.
Governor Lamont is here this morning taking our questions, and let's go to this question this morning from Allison, Governor Lamont. It's talking about the clarity of the lead poison inspections. This was something we talked about the last time you came on and was just looking for an update. How exactly it's going to work? I know about a month or two ago, you made it a very big point that this is a problem. We have spoken to doctors that this is a hidden epidemic here in Connecticut, that there are about 30,000 children who have lead poisoning or potential lead poisoning, or maybe it was 3,000. Big difference, but still thousands of children, unfortunately, who are exposed to lead poisoning, and there can be very long-term effects for them, even for adults. So any more clarity or update on to how these inspections will work for lead poisoning in homes here in Connecticut?
Yeah, excellent question, Allison. A couple of things. One, we're an old state, a lot of charm, but we have a lot of really old buildings and old pipes. Old meaning anything more than a 40 or 50 years old probably has some lead things we got to check out. You know, we've got tens of millions of dollars. We're changing out lead pipes as we speak. That's under the bill passed, the infrastructure bill last year. A big deal, especially for a state like us. And yes, we are sending inspectors out to check in terms of lead paint in particular. They get out there with an x-ray fluorescent analyzer. We have our own certified folks that do that. You can go to CTE licensing. You can get somebody certified from our Department of Public Health. We'll be there to check this out for you.
So do landlords request it and get the service for free? Is the state sort of identifying households that were built before 1970 and just automatically inspecting them? Or like how I know there's a way, obviously, to inquiry about it, but how will it work on a larger scale, I guess?
I think it depends on the situation. I've got to report back to you. Obviously, if it's a HUD building, you know, the feds are responsible for that and maintaining the quality. If it's a landlord doing this, we work with the landlord, especially if it's an older building. We know where those older buildings are. We know where there's most at risk. We go out and we work out an arrangement. We can get things tested. And then for the remediation, work with them on that as well.
Well, because I'm thinking, like, off the cuff, you know, like in Bridgeport, for example, is it something that falls on, like, the Ganim administration? Like, is it something that Mayor Ganim, he knows that city inside and out, and if he's like, hey, I know this section, these homes are from the 1960s, and they're rented out, and they're rental properties, we should have somebody come out. Like, is that something that we should be tasking administrations or first electmen and women with as well, or is that kind of extra?
Well, you can call your local Department of Public Health, like the one in Bridgeport, or you call us. We send out our certified inspector. We do the test. We check for the paint. We check for water quality, because you're right. This is a lingering problem, sort of endemic of older states like Connecticut, where so much of our infrastructure was built more than 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. Governor Lamont is here taking some of your questions. So Republicans recently proposed more tax cuts to happen before July 1st when the budget goes into effect, including a sales tax week now continuing as basically sales tax free for at least the end of the year, it sounds like. We actually had Senator Kevin Kelly on the show not too long ago, and he was talking about some of these tax breaks. It sounds like Senator Bob Duff, for example, in a recent article, he's not really a fan of the idea of more tax cuts. So I wanted to kind of lobby it to you and see what you think of these proposals.
Well, first of all, we are implementing the biggest tax cut for the middle class in the history of the state, and that's about $650 million plus. And we could have used some Republican support on that. Now they've come forward with their own plan for $750 million. Fortunately, our $650 million cut is kicking in over the next 30 to 60 days. I want to provide immediate relief for people now, given where inflation is. Obviously, we were the third state in the country to do the gas tax cut. We did that on a bipartisan basis. Thank you. But now it's property tax, it's car tax, it's ending the tax on your pensions and 401k, the child tax credit, the earned income. Those are all things you're going to be able to avail yourself of in the next 30 to 60 days. I want to make a difference now for people.
And interestingly enough, I noticed, and this is in our news, actually, that the state just launched a new program for first-time homeowners, the Time to Own program, making $20 million available to help cover down payments and closing costs. And applicants can actually get up to $50,000 if they're buying a home in a high-opportunity area. What does that mean, a high-opportunity area?
Those are areas that are either federally deemed distressed based upon the average income in those communities. I believe in home ownership. I think there's nothing like being an owner. A lot of folks don't have enough scratch to be able to make the down payment. We're helping with that. Some of them just have a lot of student debt, so that's slowed down their opportunity to get a mortgage as well. So we're doing what we can to facilitate home ownership for folks, especially in communities where people otherwise can't afford it.
So, Governor Lamont, I mean, $20 million sounds like an awful lot, but I'm trying to figure out, you know, obviously ballpark, you don't have to give me an exact number, but just with the housing market right now and how expensive it is, it certainly is a seller's market, not buyers. How many people potentially could this really help? I would imagine a lot of people jump on this.
I don't know if everybody gets the full $50,000, but $20 million is a pretty good start. You sound like a legislator. How come we're not a anymore, but I think it's a first-time program. I think it's going to make a difference. Let's see how it works, because I am a big believer in home ownership.
Mm-hmm. Well, Governor Lamont, I really appreciate you coming on. For anyone who I missed your question, we will add it to the list. But the next time Governor Lamont will be on will be next month. So I wish you and your family a very happy 4th of July weekend, and we'll talk in a few weeks.
Right back at you, Melissa, and everybody be safe. Take care, everybody.
Thank you. Governor Ned Lamont here on WICC.
This bill will not end the epidemic of gun violence overnight. This bill doesn't include everything that Dick and I support, but it is substantial. It is significant. It will save lives, and it will provide us the momentum to be able to make further changes. That's why I describe this as a breakthrough moment. A lot of work to go between here and passage between the moment that the president signs this into law. But I'm just grateful to this movement that stands behind me. I'm grateful to my colleagues for allowing us to get here.
So you're hearing from Senator Chris Murphy. And of course, this is the big national and even local story here in Connecticut, gun reform in the United States. And one of the compromises here is, sure, we're going to address some of the gun rights, or I should say some of the gun reform ideas that the Democrats have been pushing for many, many years. But it's coupled with a lot of focus on mental health investment, which is what the Republican Party has been pushing for many years. Joining me this morning is Gary McNamara. Now, Gary is the former chief of police in Fairfield, Connecticut, but he also currently works at Sacred Heart University, and he is in touch constantly with the students on campus there. And I wanted to chat with Gary about some of the items in this, I don't even want to call it a bill because it hasn't even been drafted yet, but this bipartisan, I'm going to call it tentative agreement. Good morning, Gary. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Melissa, and thanks for having me.
So first of all, Gary, from your professional standpoint, especially because you were the chief when Sandy Hook happened almost 10 years ago, do you think what's currently being proposed and potentially will pass as early as July, do you think it is going to make a significant difference when you talk about things like mass shootings in schools?
Well, I mean, it's a framework. I mean, I think that's what we should be referring to it as, a framework. There's a lot of meat that has to go on the bones. But I think a significant difference, I don't think initially at all. But certainly it's the start of trying to problem solve as opposed to just discuss different rhetoric. And it's important that we kind of look at problems and look at steps to at least begin to solve them. And so I think the framework is there to now look at some of these things as being solutions. So there are significant things in there that will help in some areas. But, you know, it's an ongoing issue that we're always going to have to work on. So this is not, hey, one and done and we're done. Let's relax. We've solved the problem. We haven't. But at least it's the framework, and the discussions, I'm sure, are going to continue in a variety of different ways. And it's important to let's see what's really in there. And then let's see application, because a lot of what exists today, and we can talk about it for a few minutes, there are things that exist now that, you know, within the state of Connecticut or elsewhere. But the problem is it's not operational as effective as it could be.
So what do you mean by that, Gary? Let's get into it. What are you talking about? Give me an example.
Sure. Well, you know, the first of all, the state of Connecticut in 1999, after the Newington lottery shooting, has a risk warrant statute in place. That's the red flag law. And that is effective, and I believe it's effective. We've used it in Fairfield. Officers continue to use it to take handguns away from people who may be a risk to themselves or others. So I think, and it gives that like temporary pause. So I think that that's really important, especially in the framework and the federal level that we do that. But some of the other things, the NICS background check. And so the NICS is the national database. It's really a national instant criminal background check system. So it's national. And people who go and purchase firearms, sellers of firearms, not hand-to-hand, customer-to-customer, but businesses that sell firearms, when you go in and purchase a firearm, they're supposed to review and check that background system. The problem is that a lot of states don't put the information within the background system, within that NICS system. So we're only getting half of the picture. That's kind of what I mean by operationalizing the framework. Let's make sure we have the laws, but make sure that if these are the laws that are out there, that we're doing everything we can to make sure that all the information, all the appropriate information is put into it so that people purchasing guns or selling guns can make the decisions based upon what we're saying the decision should be based on. You know, mental health is another issue. I mean, there's a lot of that information. We want to make sure that whatever we're saying is going to be used to decide who has a gun. Make sure that we're getting the full picture. That's kind of what I'm saying.
Gary McNamara is the Chief Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University, and we're talking about this bipartisan tentative agreement between Republicans and Democrats in Congress and potentially seeing some kind of legislation drafted and even passed as early as July. You know, it's interesting, Gary, what you were just saying, which is operational. I was talking about this a couple weeks ago, how I walked freely into a Bridgeport school I had never been to before, and I was just buzzed in, never asked a question, there were no cameras. And I think to myself, you know, we talk about investing in school safety, but we even here in Connecticut or even as a nation have become lax in some of those things. So is that a good comparison? Like, you know, it's great if we had things like universal background checks, for example, but do all states, do all shops, do all gun sellers, do they follow those protocols? Is that what you're saying?
I am, yeah, and within arm's reach. I mean, your example is a good one. You know, local solutions solve the problems oftentimes. So the federal government, and again, look, I think this is a good discussion and a good framework. So I'm not raining on anybody's parade, and I don't think anybody's really celebrating it. I mean, you know, the work that went into it, and I can, you know, you can tell they're not really celebrating it. But absolutely, you have to operationalize the plans. Okay, if they're talking red flag laws, mental health. Closing some of the loopholes as it relates to domestic violence and interpersonal violence and who can have guns. That's great. Put it in writing, but let's make sure we invest in operationalizing it. Everybody understands it. You know, the investment in school security, investment in all those aspects, just make sure that on the local level, everybody understands the role, and we're all doing what we can to operationalize what they put in place.
We're chatting this morning with Gary McNamara, who is the Chief Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University. He also was the former Chief of Police in Fairfield for quite some time. And I like to go to Gary about a lot of times national stories that have a direct impact here in Connecticut. And right now we're talking about the tentative agreement. I don't know what to call it because they haven't even made a document yet. But we have heard that Republicans and Democrats who have been trying to craft some kind of legislation on gun reform and mental health have come up with a tentative plan, essentially. They need to draft it. They need to get approval from the House and the Senate. It's got to be signed by the president. They're hoping to do it before their break in July. With that being said, Gary, let's talk about the mental health portion of this. They are investing billions of dollars into mental health for youth, for elementary ed, for communities. They are investing in more telehealth. What I first of all find interesting about that is that we weren't just going to do that anyways because of so many reports that showed we are struggling immensely in America post-pandemic. But what do you think about this? And do you feel that this really addresses especially that age group that so many people have been fearful of with gun violence, the 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds? And you kind of see a lot of that age bracket because you work at a college campus.
Yeah, I do. I think that anything that we can do to invest in the mental wellness of all of us is really, really important. And I agree with you. Whether they would have done it or not, who knows? But certainly to include that within the bill or the framework, I think is really important. You know, all of us have to normalize our feelings, our mental wellness, and so normalize the fact that it's okay to feel not okay and know that there are resources out there to prevent it from ever getting to the point where someone with a mental health issue is contemplating purchasing, obtaining a firearm. So a lot of that front-end investment has to go to normalizing that mental health discussion and resources so that we can prevent it from ever getting to the point where decisions have to be made whether somebody should be allowed to purchase a gun or not. That front loading is really, really important.
And the extensive, or I shouldn't even say extensive because I don't know exactly. I'll be anxious to talk to Senator Blumenthal about this a little bit more later this week. But the idea of investigating under 21 gun purchasers. And it just sounds like you're basically going to their local police department and there's like a waiting period to go, hey, let's just check you out with your local police. I was kind of hoping for more, but maybe you can kind of weigh in on this. Like, you know, as the former chief, if someone were to call you and say, hey, we've got so-and-so, they want to buy an assault weapon. Maybe not here in Connecticut because we don't, but in another part of the country, let's just say. You know, you wouldn't necessarily have records of if this person is seeing a therapist or a psychologist or if they've had any kind of an episode, right? Unless they came through your local department. I'm trying to think what's significant about this investigation period, because you can't really include doctors or psychologists or even teachers for that matter to say, hey, we've been worried about this student.
Sure. And that kind of goes back to the discussion about operationalizing it, because you're right. Where would I go to make those decisions? So if you look at the end, let's go to the end of it, the decision to sell or not sell. that's really ultimately. So someone's made the decision at that age or any age to get purchase a firearm, obtain a firearm. That's the decision point. Now you go back. You want to make sure that people are still seeking help, because if they're fearful that if I seek help, I'm not going to be able to buy a gun, then they may not seek help, or for whatever other reason.
True.
I can't get a job.
That's a good point.
So we want to make sure that we normalize it and we don't prevent people from seeking help. We talked about it a couple weeks ago or a month ago, you and I, about law enforcement officers fearful of seeking help because they don't want to lose their job.
Right.
Then once they do that, then a doctor has to be able to share that information somewhere. And they have to be confident that they're not going to get in trouble for it. So they want to make sure that they, hey, somewhere there has to be somewhere to go to get that information. And then, you know, that's kind of the thing. And then people have to have access to that at that decision point to see whether or not it's utilized. So I think, you know, we want to go avoid the situation in the first place, but I think we really have to hone in where's the data, where's the information going to be that that decision point is going to be affected by a decision on under 21's mental health picture.
Right.
I don't know where that's going to be. So it would be difficult, but certainly those discussions have to continue.
Yeah. So Gary McNamara was kind of dropping out there, but what he was saying was we need that data. We need to understand where that data is coming from and what's really going to matter for those under 21 gun buyers. And that is to be determined. And I certainly want to understand, like I said, that piece of this proposed framework a little bit more. Gary, I always appreciate getting your perspective on it, your professional opinion on these matters. Again, the Chief Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University, but also the former Chief of Police in Fairfield, Connecticut. Thank you so much for your time.
Melissa, thank you. These discussions are important. Thank you for always continuing to have them.
Yeah, absolutely, Gary. And I appreciate you being a part of them.
Family, relationships, and personal growth. Professional counselor Julius Dudix is here to help. Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Julius, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good, Melissa. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. I know you and I just started to talk about this the last time you came on, and I'm glad we're going to dive into it this morning. The effect of media and mental health of our children, and how do we better protect them, but also not go overboard? We were talking about the viral videos, the hubby wubby videos that have been recently reported here and across the country as being very dangerous, inflicting pain, teaching our children horrific things. And unfortunately, a lot of the times, these kids are streaming these videos and video games and this online content without parents even knowing it.
Right, right. And the bottom line is what's happening is they're becoming desensitized slowly. It's a process that happens over time. When a child, when they view something like that, the brain takes a picture of it. And before you know it, then they begin talking with other their friends about it and so forth. Hey, look what I found. Look what I saw. And you become slowly desensitized to violent behavior. Slowly desensitized to sexual activity online and so forth, and you become just like the frog in the kettle. I've mentioned this before. You become you boil. You get hurt yourself. So you have to build on truth, Melissa. And the truth is that children who spend more than 4 hours a day statistically are more likely to be overweight. Kids who view violence on screen are more likely to show aggressive behavior and to fear. To fear that the world is a scary place and that something bad is going to happen to me. It's the root of many times the root of anxiety in kids. So parents have to really be proactive and take a stand and really communicate and build a relationship with your child so that you're aware and become educated of Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, Snapchat, Instagram, Kick, Ask.fm. There's so many new forums coming out. But I mainly am worried about the desensitization of our kids, any of our parents. So, yeah.
And Julius, clarify for me. The last thing you just said there, based on statistics, so this is data, right. Hard, cold facts that you have. What did you say about fear that something is going to happen to me? What did you say about that?
Yeah, kids who view a constant diet of media and so forth that's inappropriate, a lot of times the violence on screen, kids are A, they're more likely to show aggressive behavior, but B, they're also more likely to fear that our world is just
a scary
place.
So they live in fear. They're okay. I see what you're saying. Yes. And you know, and I think that's that triggers right into mental health as well. The idea that every single thought in their head, every action, everything that they do every day is based on a fear, which is which is horrific. That's just terrible.
Right. You build your life on truth. And the truth is, yes, you want to be aware of some of the predators that are out there.
Right.
And parents especially need to be aware and have conversation and make sure your child is talking to you about all these things. But at the same time, you can't build on fear, because then you're going to have anxiety, stress, and all that.
So then, you know what, from a parent, a grandparent, a guardian, a teacher perspective, say you've got younger kids in your life. What's that balance, though, Julius? Because you and I have talked about this before, being an overprotective helicopter, I don't let my kids grow kind of a parent, which is an extreme, to the I trust my kids. You know, I got to be honest with you, Julius. You just said two or three apps on there that I myself have never heard of. I think there are parents out there, there are adults out there who don't know, even if they've heard of them, they don't know how these applications or how this online world works to its extent, and maybe to an extent they don't want to know, but they're allowing their kids to access it. So where's that balance of, you know, those two extremes are not healthy. So what's the balance?
Every family is different. And what happens is, if you know, you can go far to the right or you can go far to the left. And I like to kind of help people stay in the middle. And just ask them, you know, what's the truth here, and what are your kids' needs? You know your child better than anybody else. But it really boils back to, you want to find out what you should do, but do I have the relationship with my child so that they'll be able to feel emotionally safe with me, so that if something they see something on the screen, or I can ask them without them getting defensive about what's going on with your media viewing and so forth. Are you being cyber bullied? Are you a cyber bullier kind of a thing? But rules without relationship, rebellion. I've said that before. You, as a parent, if you have rules without relationship with your child, it's going to equal rebellion. And that's where you have to build that, you know, the common ground with your child, get to know your child. And then you have to get to know social media. And to your point, I didn't before. I research and so forth all the time things. And I didn't know about this KIK or Reddit.
Never heard of that. I have no idea what you're talking about. That was one of the ones you said in the ask.fm or something. I was like, I have no idea what those are. I've never heard of those.
Yeah. But so as a parent, you want to educate yourself. But then you want to have that relationship so that the child feels emotionally safe with you. So they're, and again, it's very normal for kids when they get to be 12, 13, 14 years old to want to close their door and go to their room and all that kind of thing. And that's a normal kind of an occurrence. But the wise parent is able to build that relationship and give the child space, but at the same time have the relationship with them so they can talk about things.
Yeah, no question. Julius, I think this is a fantastic topic. I know parents kind of fall all over with this, you know, where do I land? Am I doing things right? Am I not doing enough? And you know what is hard about this world is there is no parenting book 101, the best way to handle your kids in a social media era. Good Lord, there's just not. So if people want to call out, they want your help, what can they do?
You can call the office at 203-243-7714 and make an appointment, or you could read about me on Facebook or LinkedIn or the www.barkbark.website. I've got a profile on that. So, Melissa. And next week, I'm going to be on vacation. So I will see you in, I guess, 3 weeks.
I'll see you in July. Yep, and then I'm going to Hawaii. So, yes, I will see you in July, Julius.
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
I am so excited.
I'm excited too.
Vacations are healthy, mentally healthy to get out, get it.
Amen, brother. Good Lord. Yeah. Yes. Enjoy New Jersey. You deserve it, and all the work that you do, you and your family, please, please enjoy. And I will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Melissa. You have a good day.
All right. You too. Julius Dudek's here on WICC.